Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to today's Indiana Chamber of Commerce Policy Issue Conference Call, hosted by Mr. Tom Schuman. During the presentation, all lines will be in a listen-only mode. If you have a question at any point during today's presentation, please press star 1. Again, to ask a question at any time, press star 1. Thank you for your attention. At this time, I would now like to turn the conference over to your host, Mr. Tom Schuman.
Thank you, and good morning, everyone, for our final Indiana General Assembly policy call of the 2019 session. When we were last with you just 2.5 weeks ago, we talked about the possibility that played out of the General Assembly completing its work early, which they did 6 days ago now on Wednesday the 24th. Get my math right there. We have four members of the Chamber's Government Affairs team with us today. We're going to discuss what led to the closing, wrapping up work early, and then try to give a big picture view of the legislative session, some of the key accomplishments that took place, areas where things may have fallen short, and some other insights. Bill Waltz in Tax and Fiscal Policy, Jason Bierce, Education and Workforce Development, Greg Ellis, Energy, Environment, Infrastructure, Adam Berry, Economic Development and Technology, all with us today. Bill, I want to turn to you first. As we mentioned during that prior call, we talked about the budget, obviously, that must come into play. Everything worked out there. There seemed to be a number of factors that fell into place, so to speak, to allow the legislators to wrap up their work last week, 5 days ahead of when the actual deadline was.
Yeah, I think it was a pretty deliberate kind of conscious effort that you saw in play throughout the session by the leadership to not bring us down to a point of a situation like last year where it was kind of a fiasco. I suspect that was very present in their mind. If that's in fact what they were thinking, They acted on that, I think, by dealing with all the large controversial bills and actually everything kind of as quickly as they could with an eye towards getting done early. I think the budget, whenever you have a limited number of dollars and, a situation where they want to be pretty fiscally conservative, as they tend to be anyway, and just not a lot of issues wrapped up in the budget. The budget made it possible for the budget to be pretty smooth, and with the budget being pretty smooth, that kind of frees up the avenues for other bills like the gaming bill to at least have its time. Everybody taking the time to figure out what to do there.
So, Bill, regarding the budget, again, 5 days after we did our last call is when that updated revenue forecast came out and showed a decrease in funding available based on the forecast. But as I've heard you mention several times, yes, it's a big decrease if they were talking about our pocketbooks, but when it comes to a $34 billion-plus state budget, really not a too significant a number for them to adjust to.
No, if you do the math, it's a very, I forget what it is, like 0.1% or something. So not a big number. And again, the fiscal leaders and the budget makers, we're not surprised, I don't think, by that. I mean, they're working on those numbers throughout the session. They have a pretty good idea. I think they knew they were going to come in pretty close, and they had just kind of once again planned accordingly and made sure that if it was a little bit over or a little bit under, they'd be able to deal with that. So I think they...
So no surprises is good news in this case.
Right. You get too much money available and everybody's fighting over it. And if you have too little, then you've got a problem. So I think they wanted to stay away from that, and the revenue projections accommodated them.
Thoughts from others as we continue on this subject of how the session was able to wrap up as you saw things come into play during those closing weeks? Anything surprising, or it all just kind of worked out as maybe as anticipated?
Yeah, this is Adam. I think, you know, the understanding was that the delay or what slowed things down towards the end was reaching a compromise on the gaming bill. So I think once the legislators were able to sort of give concessions to all different sides, work out the mobile gaming issue, sports betting, that really allowed for the pieces to fall into place.
I think that I wouldn't say delay. I think that last week was very deliberate, and it was full speed ahead. The conference committees, they were flying through those the first couple days, and, you know, if it didn't get a conference committee meeting and report, it was left by the roadside.
They have a sense for it. Do you believe there were more bills that did not advance during these last few weeks than normal, or is that hard to judge?
I think it's hard to judge. It just seemed like there were a lot of conference committees earlier than normal.
Yeah, we talked about that a little bit last time, certainly.
I mean, the closest thing I think to a surprise at the end, although one could argue how much of it was actually a surprise versus just a very deliberate play and close to the vest, was that, you know, the Republicans found more money for schools and for teacher pay. You know, Bosma kind of teed it up the last week that there was one surprise coming, and I don't know if all of us were necessarily surprised, but certainly there was much more money than there had been originally indicated that went towards that purpose.
Jason, if you would, on that subject, give a little bit of an overview of the various pots of money going to education. It's been such a high-profile topic, one that started off with a lot of people in agreement, then some from the education community unhappy with what was taking place, but kind of give an overview of where we ended up on that.
Yeah, it was interesting. There was some not familiar faces around the table, at least at the same time at the beginning of the session, with folks from the ISTA meeting with, you know, Todd Houston, who, you know, is the primary budget writer, among others. By the end, some of that linking of arms had kind of separated a bit. They uncharacteristically did a press conference, the House did, in the chambers, included notably most of the school associations in terms of, like, the business officials and folks like that. It did not, however, include ISTA or Superintendent McCormick, which I think is indicative of the fact that neither ISTA nor the superintendent thought that they were doing enough at the end of the day in terms of more money for teachers and for schools. But I think most people, myself included, were surprised that they were able to pull as much together as they could, given that we head into this session knowing that there was a lot of money already kind of set aside for DCS and the Department of Child Services and the needs there. So the fact that they were able to pull a bit of a coup and get both of those done in one session, I think, was somewhat of a pleasant surprise given all the things that they were trying to balance. In terms of the different pots of money, you know, the increase in tuition support, which, and this is a bit of a disconnect and something that we're going to have to be watching closely over the next couple of years, is that, you know, for all the attention paid to the need for increasing teacher pay, what hasn't received quite nearly as much attention is how much of that is really left up to the local discretion of school administrators. I mean, if you look at year after year, for the most part, the General Assembly has increased funding for schools, maybe not as much as the schools would like, but it's been moving in a positive direction.
Let me jump in there a second. Just an interesting point I just read yesterday in Louisiana. Out of the past decade, said 9 of the past 10 years, there has been no increase for K-12 education in their state budget.
Right. I believe there's been some level of increase for K-12 every single year. It, you know, generally single digits, which some people would like it to be a lot more than that, but still significant.
Yeah, the last several budgets.
Yeah, but the subtext of that, though, is that teacher pay has pretty much stagnated and not declined across the state. So that kind of speaks to this issue that the state's putting more money with the intent that at least a portion of that show up on teachers' paychecks, but that hasn't really been how it's shaken out. There was another piece of legislation that got a bit of attention at the beginning and then kind of seemed to be under the radar for the remainder, which was setting what are called school expenditure targets. So calling upon the school districts to publish publicly what portion of their dollars are going to what they would call true educational expenses, you know, for teachers and instruction as opposed to administrators and other things. So that's something that, you know, at the chamber we've been looking at this issue closely. You know, we've continued to maintain that, you know, some of our school districts, particularly in rural areas, are going to have a really hard time. You know, we need to revisit the business model potentially because they have stagnating or declining enrollment. They're not going to be able to grow themselves out of these holes. They're often the same districts that have the biggest challenge passing referenda because people don't want to pay more taxes in those areas. And, you know, the state is just not inclined, it was here, to do special set-asides or carve-out to bail out individual districts. And so, you know, we want to take a closer look at the chamber and through our chamber foundation about, one, really following the money. Where are those dollars going? Are they actually ended up where we hope them to be? And then are there greater efficiencies that can be realized, you know, particularly in rural areas where you have a large number of districts, in our view, perhaps more so than can be sustained for the long term. But I went on a bit of a tangent there.
Jason, let me jump in. One follow-up on that, though. We did end up with some type of recommendation on how what percentage of dollars should go to the classroom. Is that correct?
Yeah, I believe that there's I'm substance, and there was an 85-15% rule. The interesting thing about all the furor around that piece of legislation at the beginning is you would have thought that there was an actual stick associated with it. There'd be, you know, some sort of intervention if schools fell short of that. It's really just a reporting requirement, and, you know, schools might be called upon if they're not consistently, you know, staying within that in those parameters. For corrective actions they might take. But again, in terms of direct, specific interventions that would come from schools or districts that aren't staying within that threshold, that wasn't really part of the equation. But you would have thought the way it was covered, particularly in the media, that there was a much more of a hammer associated with that.
And as I recall, even during the Daniels administration, there was a lot of discussion around this topic, and it seemed to be a lot of confusion over what expenses qualify as a classroom expenditure as opposed to non. So
dollars for the classroom has been a gray area for a long time. And, you know, one of the challenges of school districts, as Tom's pointing out, have a lot of latitude in how they decide to categorize their expenses. And they often will say things that some might not consider to be a, you know, instructional expense. Are, you know, essential in order to support the instruction, whether that be instructional support staff who are non-teachers technically or even administrators. So I think this is one of those issues that there's a lot of nuances to it, but I think there's increasing attention on this issue. You know, the governor created this teacher pay commission. They've been kind of meeting quietly, haven't heard much about what conclusions, if any, they've come to at this point. But I think at the chamber we're going to be following that conversation closely, also looking to see if there's some research that we can be doing to maybe shine a bit more light on this issue, if for no other reason, for us not to have some of the same conversations 2 years from now. But beyond that, there are a couple other smaller grant funds, mostly at the instigation of Representative Bob Boehning, won some funding for teacher career ladders, which is the phrase describing giving teachers an opportunity to increase their compensation for taking on additional responsibilities or for their effectiveness, not just about years of service. There was another grant fund called Teacher Residency Grants that is basically a fund specifically for universities that provide some sort of ongoing mentoring during the first year for new teachers. So all of these different proposals at some level are really designed, one, to better compensate teachers with the hope that they'll stay in the classroom longer, but then just provide additional support that's going to increase the retention rates as well.
Tom, I was just going to add a couple other things to your original question on the budget and the context of education funding and finding new money. And I would suggest that they actually found a lot of money at the beginning, you know, because there was a lot of money going towards education in the governor's budget and the House budget and the Senate budget. So they had that going. And so they were able at the end to say, oh, yeah, managed to meet that priority and found money, but they kind of had it there all along. And the other thing that's worth mentioning, I think, is the transfer ability. They are transferring $150 million to kind of buy down the teachers' retirement funds, which is an obligation, you know, at the local level, ongoing. And so that's pretty advantageous in freeing up some money.
And I'm glad you mentioned that, Bill. I think it's indicative of, although they didn't have as much money as they might have hoped to focus this issue because of DCS, I'll give some credit to the Daniels administration, the Hogan administration. They were kind of creative in finding different ways to relieve some of the pressure on the locals, given that they didn't have as much resources as they expected or hoped for to begin with. But that's a good point, Bill.
I would just add, I mean, the reason why this obviously is so important to again state one of the obvious reasons, the importance of the teacher in the classroom, and they are vital to the learning of our students, and keeping teachers and fairly compensating them is a critical issue. We hope to see continued improvement in that area. A little bit of a status report of where things stand. I just looked even this morning on the governor's website. We talk about the action of the General Assembly. The governor has a little bill watch update on his website. He has addressed the most of the pieces of legislation that have passed the General Assembly. There are about 30 bills left for him to deal with. The deadline for that is 6 days from now, next Monday on May 6th. He either has to sign, veto, or let become law without a signature of the remaining pieces of legislation. Listen, the media reports, probably the one that stands out is one that he's still giving strong consideration to would be the gaming bill. Seems to be undecided on that as a comprehensive piece of legislation with a lot of moving parts in that. And I guess one of the things that's indicative of how complex that bill is that Representative Houston, who you mentioned earlier, carried that bill and ended up voting against it on the final vote. We're going to turn to a bit of a more of a broader overview here. We're going to go around the table with each of your advocacy team members, again, talking about some of the major events of the session as a whole. I do want to remind you again, we want to address your questions, your comments, anytime throughout the call. Simply hit star one for your questions. Let's look big picture. Adam, we'll start with you. What do you view as the most impactful piece of legislation that was enacted in your issue areas?
I think without question, it was Senate Bill 563, which really updated a lot of the tax incentives available to the IEDC to attract capital and talent to the state. Within Senate Bill 563 was BCI transferability. That's the Venture Capital Investment Tax Credit. We are really lagging behind many of the other states. I think we're 33rd in BC attraction.
And that's low 30s, yeah.
Yeah, and so transferability is a great first step. Unfortunately, because of negotiations with 21 fund dollars, the transferability provision is delayed 1 year, but I think that gives the IEDC, as well as the Chamber, an opportunity to work with members of the General Assembly to talk about what else can be done during the 2020 session, especially with making the application process and the issuance more efficient.
Yeah, that's something, Adam, the 21 fund we did not talk about during our calls, I think, and in the closing days of session, there was going to be about an $8 million decline in funding for that, and that was restored pretty much to where it was, correct?
That's right, yes. It was restored. Again, they folks from the governor's office, as well as the fiscal folks in the General Assembly, wanted to pull that money, quote-unquote, pull the money from somewhere to restore the 21 fund dollars, and the math worked out so that by delaying the transferability, they figured that $8 million could be saved in the first fiscal year, which thing was what they did, what they used to restore the 21 funds.
Too bad we couldn't throw a different math formula in there for them and had both of those.
I agree.
BCI now and restore 21
funds. I agree.
Funding.
There were a couple other trends there that came up, allowed them to come up with that money. So.
And again, the 21 fund, is since its inception, has been used in a variety of different ways. Today, a lot of it, the purview of Elevate Ventures and the work they do around the state with their partnerships in different regions, just various ways to assist entrepreneurs and small business owners. We also, in that legislation, you mentioned some other tax credits, also very helpful to some small business owners, some adjustments in some of the existing credits.
Right. So I think, though not a tax credit, the R&D voucher, authorizing the R&D voucher for companies to apply to the IEDC, what is essentially going to be a matching voucher where companies, small businesses, can leverage the intellectual capital at our public universities, or at all universities, public and private, as well as other research organizations certified by the IEDC, to leverage those groups for technology and other human capital.
Greg Ellis, same question for you. Talk about an impactful piece of legislation in your issue areas.
I think I have two, Tom, and I'll be brief. Probably the most impactful, and this probably sounds very boring, but was Senate Bill 535, and that was extraterritorial matters, where it basically prohibited local municipalities from zoning using eminent domain outside their corporate limit with the exception of a two-mile buffer zone if there was no county zoning. That will solve a lot of issues that businesses and residents are having with local government, you know, far reach.
I could see, you say maybe boring, but I could see it being potentially chaotic if there wasn't this in place, if there was certain areas of overreach.
Well, one of the things Senator Booch had shown us at the beginning of the session, he had a map drawn out with municipalities and the overlaps that they have, and it looked like for those of us that are older, the spirograph when we were the kids, that's what it looked like.
Oh, you are showing your age, right? at least you didn't say like the etch-a-sketch or something.
But that was one, and I think that was a very important bill. Another one that has the potential to be very impactful was House Bill 1278. It started out as IDEM's omnibus bill where they fixed things. It turned into a Christmas tree. They added the ability for IDEM to adjust their fees by rulemaking, which we will need to be involved with when they go that route. Then they stuck the Energy Task Force language in there from Representative Soliday, which that could impact the bottom line of every business. And so those were both the important ones, I believe.
Jason, how about you?
Well, other than the budget, I think the most impactful bill in my area was House Bill 1002, in part because that was sort of the acknowledged workforce bill coming from the governor's office and included a lot of the recommendations that came from the governor's workforce cabinet, but also because by the end of the session, that bill, too, had turned into a bit of a Christmas tree. I think at last count, it had at least three different bills in addition to its origin bill from the beginning, so there was a lot of pieces of legislation that were kind of found their way into 1002. I think for the folks on this call, the most significant pieces there, one, it significantly increased the amount of dollars available to the governor's two Next Level Jobs grant programs, that Workforce Ready grant that will pay for an individual to get a high-demand certificate from a number of different institutions, including Ivy Tech and Vincennes, and then reimbursement grants for employers to do their own training, the employer training grant. Both of those funds saw significant dollar increases. A number of other provisions that were in the original bill, mostly around efforts to try and strengthen career and technical education programming at the secondary level and also consolidate some of the authority in that regard under the governor's cabinet. Other pieces of legislation that found their way into 1002 over time, one, Senate Bill 420, which there are a lot of moving parts to this one, but what ended up being what are called industry collaboration organizations. The goal here is that there be an incentive for employers to come together as a sector or across sectors to engage with their schools and build up programming or opportunities like work-based learning that, you know, align with workforce needs. The original version of that bill included a tax credit. The tax credit went away, and so for a period of time there was going to be these entities that may or may not have any reason to exist because there's no real incentive for employers to come together. But by the end of the session, there was a connection between those entities and funding that might be available through the cabinet for various functions. Another bill that found its way into 1002 was House Bill 1404, which is around outcomes-based school accountability. The goal with that was, is the state in a position to move beyond test scores and graduation rates as the primary measures for our schools producing the outcomes that the state needs? A lot of controversy around that bill, and ultimately what came out of that was there's going to be a creation of a panel, a task force, probably analogous to the graduation pathways panel that came out a couple years ago with representation from the chamber, among others. They're going to look at making some recommendations that would come back to the General Assembly. And beyond that, I mean, even to give you an idea of what a Christmas tree this will turn into, there was even language from a bill about which teacher license exam the state is going to be using, which we don't really have a super strong opinion about, but I think it just gives you a sense of kind of the range of topics that, for one reason or another, got folded into House Bill.
Well, let me be a little naive here, which I am, because I'm not across the street every day like you guys are, and Greg and Jason, you both mentioned these Christmas tree bills. Why does so much of that take place? Why do things not pass on their own in their original bill and then become part of this large bill at the end?
Well, sometimes it's just bad legislation, but in my case where they stuck the energy task force in the environmental bill, the Senate had already said it wasn't germane to the bill that it got stuck in, so the House was able to do a little creative drafting.
Creative. You know, it's interesting. I think traditionally the House has always been a lot more open to throwing things into a bill that may or may not be germane, and the Senate's always been a bit more reluctant to do so. But those rules seem to be going away, at least this session. There were multiple pieces or language that found its way into bills that it'd be really hard to argue that it's at all germane. Just a quick example, there was a bill that had to do with charter schools, and by voice vote, language was amended in the Senate Education Committee that had would have required cursive writing. So this is, there's really no relationship between those two proposals other than they both involve student schools at some level. But I think there were several bills already that were called various education matters, but by the end of the session, you could arguably say that all the remaining bills were various education matters.
So we'll term it enhanced creativity at the State House.
Well, there is sometimes a strategic element there as well. They're building support for the bill because they have so many people with an interest in some piece of the bill.
Well, that was particularly true with House Bill 1002 is because it was the governor's bill, I think pragmatically some thought their language would have more of a chance of making it through and not being killed at the last minute, because generally speaking, folks in the same party don't want to embarrass their governor. So I think that in particular is why 1002 turned into a bit of a Christmas tree.
One other point, you mentioned the additional funding for next level jobs grants. Just received a communication yesterday from the Department of Workforce Development. An additional offering they're going to have coming up, a webinar specifically for minority and women-owned businesses. So we'll include a link to information about that in the follow-up to this email, and then we'll get that out to our chamber members. Bill Waltz, you're the final one on this initial question. Impactful piece of legislation.
Impactful, yeah. I think I probably have three contenders for that.
So most impactful piece.
Most.
No, go ahead. All three.
Well, it sort of depends on who you are, so I'll touch on them very quickly.
Is that a CSI reference or something? I'm sorry, I keep throwing you off. Three pieces of legislation.
All right. If you want me to get done quick, you have to let me talk.
All right.
So the Economic Development Bill 563 that Adam mentioned also had kind of a more fundamental tax policy change in it that moves Indiana to what's called market-based sourcing. That's just how you portion income for people who provide services. It essentially removes the kind of potential for double taxation for people who generate their services within Indiana and then export that or sell that outside of Indiana. Those people could get used previously would be taxed here and in the states where they provide the service. So if you're one of those people, that's pretty impactful. If you buy stuff online, you will be impacted by the Marketplace Facilitator Bill that I've talked about, where essentially it's requiring the collection by all the platforms or the people who facilitate sales transactions online. So that's going to bring in about $100 million probably, and that's important to the budget picture, of course. Keeping us away from having to find money elsewhere and tax people elsewhere. And then, if you happen to be a small business on the cusp of the de minimis personal property tax exemption that allows you to avoid paying personal property tax if you're currently have under $20,000 in personal property based on the purchase price. They doubled that threshold to $40,000 this year, and that will now encompass another 25,000 taxpayers roughly. So those people would be impacted by the rise in that threshold.
Bill, what's the potential in the future of expanding that even further? And we've made two significant steps. I believe 2015 was the first for that initial exemption, and then as you just described, that expansion this year. Difficult issue, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. There's plenty of potential for that. There's a lot of things you could do, and we will pursue the possibility of expanding that. It's a sensitive matter because you're getting into local units funds, and they believe that if you're going to take money away from them, via the expansion of that exemption, you have to find some replacement elsewhere. And we generally supported that idea. But because personal property tax is particularly egregious, as we've said for years, we would like to explore perhaps maybe changing even how there was some discussion this year and how they calculate that threshold. So it might include depreciated property. So without going into that in great detail, there's a lot of potential for still working on that.
So during the course of these calls, and certainly as our listeners followed in their local media and talked with people, a lot of attention on bias crimes, on gaming, on various pieces of legislation. How about under the radar? Were there some things that didn't receive too much attention that we haven't talked about that we're able to proceed through the process and either under the radar, either good or not so good that took place? Greg, we'll start with you.
I'll say under the radar good was Senate Bill 4, which was Senator Charbonneau's. It was a water bill. It moved through the process very quickly. It may have been the first one of mine that made it all the way through. With unanimous support all the way along, but it creates a task force to study stormwater and wastewater. But what was important in there that didn't get discussed much was the Indiana Finance Authority is now the official agency to coordinate all the executive branch water issues. So that means they will be coordinating with IDEM, DNR, the Utility Commission. So I felt that was important and went under the radar.
And you know, Greg, this continues to build on the water study that our foundation did in 2014, and we've certainly seen legislation each year, collecting more data, more organization. How do you feel about the progress that's taking place there, and are we moving quick enough, or we need to go quicker?
I think we're moving fairly quick. I won't say quick enough because there was another bill that I didn't discuss. It was a Solidate bill, House Bill 1406, where it got $20 million in the Water Infrastructure Assistance Fund that was done a couple years ago. That's not even close to the amount of money needed, but it's a start. Yesterday, the Indiana Finance Authority kicked off another study of water, and there was a kickoff meeting that I attended. So, I mean, it continues to progress, but there's still a lot of work to be done.
Others jump in on under the radar. Jason?
Yeah, well, I'll talk about this bill a bit more later in the call, but House Bill 1629, which was indeed labeled a various education matters bill, there were portions of this bill that got a lot of attention and had some controversy. There were others, aspects of the bill that got virtually no attention, and one of those is the expansion of the state's Earn Indiana work-study programs. This is basically the state's way of subsidizing internship opportunities for low-income students, so it pays half the compensation cost to the employer, so a real incentive for employers to not only support internship programs but hire students who might not have, you know, the same access to these opportunities. That program has existed for a number of years, but has been limited to college-age students. Now it's going to be expanded to high school-age students as well. So for companies, including those on this call, who are looking at ways that they can, you know, strengthen their talent pipeline, engage with students earlier, this could be a real opportunity to connect with that talent at a younger age and kind of put them on course to be permanent employees. Although I would argue, I think we would argue at the Chamber, that this is a pretty significant step with a lot of opportunity, it received virtually no attention. In fact, I think the only time it was really mentioned in committee is when someone like myself in the Chamber talked about the importance of it, but beyond that, it received very little attention from the legislature, which in this case, I was kind of relieved about, because that made sure it got through intact.
That's a good thing, and that, you know, affords us the opportunity to remind our listeners about the Indiana Internet Program and its critical role with that. You know, the Internet staff are right outside my office here at the Chamber, and they do an amazing job of working with students, working with businesses, make those connections each and every day.
And to that point, as Tom said, our Internet platform has been the facilitator for students accessing and employers accessing those Earn Indian dollars. We work really closely with the Commission for Higher Education on this, and they sent out a couple of emails to students in their database recently, and we saw at least it was several thousand increases in terms of the number of students who've got on the platform, created a profile, and, you know, on track to access these funds. So I think it shows that there's real pent-up demand among students as well as employers who are recognizing that these types of opportunities are becoming increasingly essential.
More than 10,000 students currently searching for internships on Indiana Internet, so plenty of talented people out there waiting for opportunities with your organizations.
With or without this Earn Indiana subsidy, it's probably one of the lowest cost ways for employers to source talent, but, you know, the fact that the state's going to, in fact, pick up, you know, half the tab for a summer-type internship, it's kind of a no-brainer from our perspective.
Adam or Bill? Bill?
Yeah, real fast. A bill, I had one, a bill, 623, that had to do with the big box assessment issue that we've kind of been talking about and they've been dealing with on and off here for 4 or 5 years, was a kind of particularly bad piece of legislation as introduced. It was unfortunately kind of going under the radar and flying through the Senate in the first half of the session.
Under the radar in a bad way.
In a bad way.
Okay.
And then it flew kind of under the radar in a good way in the House because it never got a hearing.
It all depends on your radar of the day.
So yeah, but it potentially had an effect on other assessments, so we're not just talking about how you assess the big retail big box stores. So anyway, that was kind of good and bad.
And I would say in my portfolio, it would be House Bill 1405, which the title is Taxation of Data Centers. Essentially what this allows the state to become competitive in these nine-figure projects where before this incentive was enacted, Indiana wasn't even on the radar of these organizations who are building these data centers across the country. And when you think about the cloud and cloud computing being the new normal for IT, the cloud is actually housed at the data center. So while there's not a huge employment at the data centers themselves, there are multiple benefits that come from and will come from this legislation.
And I believe, two of the states that are very prominent in this area are Iowa and Ohio, and I assume that's due to similar type incentives that they've enacted previously.
100%, yeah.
We've talked a lot about primarily good outcomes or good things that have taken place. Of course, any legislation or legislative session includes a bit on the opposite side. Talk a little bit about, from your perspectives, what's some of the most frustrating things that might have taken place, either in the course of the session or in eventual outcomes.
I'll jump in there real fast.
Bill's knocking everybody else down right here.
All right. So as most people that listen to me know, I actually work not just in tax, but in the local government front. So I have to mention how frustrating it was to see the House Bill 1650 would have gotten rid of the township boards, these three-member elected boards that essentially do nothing but overlook the township trustees, kind of look over their shoulder and either rubber stamp or critique another elected official. So here they had an opportunity to get rid of about 3,000 elected officials within a layer of government that itself is not needed. And it was unfortunately soundly defeated in the House because there's so many people. Now I have to go into my cynical.
As they talk for many
years. Yeah, just a lot of people who have kind of grown out of that local system in the legislature, and they just don't want to turn their back on their...
And this would have been a good common-sense step, as you say, that would have eliminated those board officials, still would have maintained the township system, but couldn't get that step across the board.
Yeah, so I'm not sure what the prospects are. There's going to have to be some kind of significant change in the view of this larger issue.
Now, there was a separate piece of legislation that passed that helps with some transparency issues with township budgets.
Yeah, there was if you want to look on the bright side, there was a little progress made in the
quarter glass folds that
happened. Yeah, so they townships have built up their some funds over the years just to kind of save up for capital expenditures is their argument, and so there was legislation that said if you're going to do that, you have to at least develop a plan and tell people and have a hearing that this we're saving up this money for this purpose and we're going to use it for this purpose ultimately. And if they have way too much in that account, it requires them to redistribute some of that. So it's a step, positive step.
Next most frustrated.
I would say my most frustrating was the process involved with there was Senate Bill 472, which started out as a fix to a water statute. It was kind of flying under the radar. Representative Soliday contacted me and said, hey, I've got this great idea. Let's do a water task force. What's the chamber think of this? And we supported that. He took 3 weeks of testimony on that. And then out of nowhere, he introduced an amendment that would have put a moratorium on new generation or shutdown of energy. The IURC wouldn't have been allowed to make any of those decisions or utilities to purchase power. I won't go into the weeds there, but the process was very frustrating because he didn't take any testimony on that. It was clear behind the scenes that every group involved, including the chamber, had told him this is a bad idea and it was full speed ahead. Fortunately, unlike Bill's, we were able to get what we wanted out of it. We got that one killed, but it was very frustrating. I had a lot of text and phone calls with Representative Soliday, some of them not so nice. In the end, we all made up, but that was frustrating.
Mm-hmm. Others?
Yeah, same bill as I mentioned last time, House Bill 1629. Another provision that ultimately did not make it through was related to the FAFSA, which if you're not familiar with that, is the financial aid form that students at any level need to fill out in order to access state, federal, or
institutional
financial aid.
I'm very familiar with that.
Yeah. So modeled after, the original proposal was modeled after Louisiana that made completion of the FAFSA a high school graduation requirement or an opt-out, so it had to be intentional. I'm either doing this or I'm not doing it, as opposed to just letting it fall through the cracks. That provision was in the running for most under the radar for the majority of the session, so much so that the Indiana Education Insight, which is sort of the trade publication, actually wrote an article about, I can't believe this isn't getting more attention. Well, it did get a lot of attention towards the end, but for interesting reasons. On the sale through the House, on the Senate side, there was a lot of concern about data privacy. It became a much bigger issue. Some senators just became aware of the state's management performance hub and the data that's being collected. A lot of concern about global ID numbers and tracking of people. From our view, there's no way a student could share their parent's tax information without the parent giving that student. There was some concern about the federal government having my private data, and our response to that would be, unless you're not paying your taxes, the federal government already has your tax information. You might ask, why does the chamber even care about this? It kind of ties to some of the other bills that I've already mentioned. All those workforce ready grants under the governor's next level jobs banner are contingent on an individual filing the FAFSA in order to identify their level of need. Same with that Earn Indiana pool of dollars that students have to file the FAFSA in order to qualify for that as well. So, at a time when increasingly our economy is tied to individuals with higher levels of skills, training, credentials beyond a high school diploma, this FAFSA has really become a real barrier to individuals getting connected with the training that they need. The most frustrating part about all this was that we'd actually worked through a compromise that we thought folks on both sides could get behind, but ultimately, and this is the kind of things that happen at the very end of the session, a legislative staffer sent the wrong draft for the conference committee report, so it basically died for no good reason. So we mostly addressed the data privacy concerns. We reiterated the fact that we're not going to make people fill out a form just because there was an opt-out for it, but ultimately, it just didn't pass just through so many things happening and something falling through the cracks. So that was fairly frustrating for me. Still think there's opportunities to get that back in play, but not this session, unfortunately.
Yeah, and I would say, in addition to the transferability, the fact that we couldn't put the bias crimes issue to bed was a miss. The chamber, with Kevin's leadership and through the Tech Policy Committee, we've been fierce advocates for a comprehensive bias crimes bill that gets Indiana off the list of states without a hate crimes bill. And while from a practical standpoint, we feel that the bill accomplishes that, there's still room for others to say that because we didn't reference a comprehensive list of characteristics or attributes, that doesn't qualify as a hate crimes bill. And we did not, the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, has come out and said that we did not make it off of their naughty list. I think that's a separate conversation for a separate day. But the fact that we couldn't put that issue to bed was a miss.
Certainly, and as we've talked previously, and as Adam just expressed, an accomplishment, probably as far as we could get the legislature to go this year, but it could have, as you said, kind of been sealed with that comprehensive list. I am going to attempt to step in for Kevin Brinegar and Mike Ripley, our two team members who are not here today, but I'm pretty confident what's at the top of their list, and that is the anti-smoking agenda. We've talked about this quite a bit. You'll see more evidence of this coming up in the next 6 weeks or so as we get ready to release our Indiana Vision 2025 report card. But, and what you're going to find there is Indiana's smoking rate is now 44th in the country. The continued impacts of that are tremendous. $6.2 billion. Cost to businesses in increased health care and lost productivity, not to mention, of course, the obvious impacts on the individuals who suffer from addictions in this area. There were several opportunities, as there have been in recent years, for the legislature to do something in this area. a cigarette tax increase, which is supported by more than 60% of the population, raising the smoking age from 18 to 21, which is supported by 65% of the population in recent polling. And even the legislature was unable, and again, as we talk in the closing weeks and the closing days, unable to impose a vaping tax on the vaping products, which is proving to be a growing epidemic in our schools. So there were three separate opportunities. We would argue all of them were important and necessary, and unable to have the General Assembly move forward on any of those. We're seeing neighboring states, it raised the smoking age. Illinois approved legislation earlier this year. Ohio's governor has voiced his support for that. So, again, I probably can't adequately express the frustration of Kevin and Mike, who work so closely on these issues, but you'll see much more on this, in our final legislative report and as we comment on the section, on the session. This is just a tremendous missed opportunity that goes beyond frustrating. It goes to really detrimental to our state.
Building on what Tom just said, there was an interesting article in the New York Times this past weekend about Juul, which, if you're familiar, is kind of the leader in this vaping. It's gotten a lot of criticism for contributing to the number of young people that have become vapers, if that's even the right word. But what the article was interesting was talking about how in the national conversation, Juul has been really savvy about positioning itself as trying to be responsible in terms of being in favor of raising the age to 21 for vaping as well as or nicotine products as well as cigarettes, removing all social media and various flavors that are cater to young people. But interestingly, in the part we've seen this borne out in Indiana, they've also at the same time on a parallel front sent out a sea of lobbyists to different state legislatures that are sort of trying to undercut any effort in all the different areas that Tom mentioned. So there's definitely a tension right now between people trying to do the right thing from a health perspective and some special interest groups that, although might be saying the right things publicly, are kind of quietly working to make sure that their business isn't threatened.
And I think that's moved up to the federal level too. I mean, we've heard things from Senator Young, Senator McConnell, and some articles.
Well, Senator McConnell, Kentucky, the Senate leader, expressing that he would author legislation in the coming weeks of raising the smoking age, but certainly some speculation there that is, again, that's a trade-off that the tobacco companies and others can live with as long as some of the many more severe restrictions are not put into place on them. We've talked a lot about legislation. Let's talk about people a little bit. Obviously, you've mentioned some of the key legislators. We saw a lot of changes this session, people moving into new roles, and certainly it takes a coordinated effort among many at the State House to make these things happen. Who are some of the legislators that you would acknowledge for the important work that they did this session that really stepped up and did a great job?
I think you got to lead with Speaker Bosma and sort of the deft use of all the tools in the toolbox to get the bias crimes bill done. I don't know without him if we would have a bias crimes bill, period. And you could argue about could have been more comprehensive, could have been stronger, but we felt pretty good midway through the session, and then everything seemed to fall apart in the Senate, and I think he gets a lot of the credit for getting it back on track and at least giving Indiana something to point to.
I would say, and Bill may or may not agree with me, in the House, Representative Steuerwald worked with Bill and I on the ALJ bill. We heard from our members that there were concerns about that. We had multiple meetings with him. He called us, asked questions.
So administrative law judge.
Yes, I'm sorry. I should have explained. Yes. And I felt that was important. Kind of a surprise was Representative Hatfield from the Evansville area. He had raised some issues during this energy moratorium that we were concerned about, and him, along with Representative Pierce, introduced an amendment, which we thought was unusual. A Democrat, I'm like, I don't know, this is going to fail, and the amendment passed.
So Representative Hatfield is a newcomer to the legislature, am I correct?
In a couple of years.
And
yeah.
Representative Matt Pierce from Bloomington,
right.
You're referring
right.
to.
In the Senate, I would say Representative Head worked with the chamber and the chamber members on some issues of concerns, both good and bad, we had with the bill, Senate Bill 517. It was about relocation of utilities and road construction projects. He killed it himself. He said that it needed more work. And then I would say Senator Bray, when we had concerns about this energy moratorium, I was able to talk to him, and he said, don't worry. So, and it worked out.
I would add to that list, I mentioned him earlier, but Representative Boehning, I mean, he's acknowledged as sort of the expert on education issues, and he showed that numerous times during the session. Things that seemed to be on the verge of falling apart managed to pull together, and then he had other pieces of legislation that he positioned in a way that they kind of sailed through the legislature. Adding to that, I'd say Representative Holly Sullivan. She's, I think, really kind of distinguished herself in the past couple of years as being a leader on workforce issues. And she did a lot in the remaining days of the session. I mentioned that what was her bill, that House Bill 1002, turned into a bit of a Christmas tree of competing interests that, you know, certain people cared very much about other provisions and those same people cared nothing about other provisions, and she, you know, was pretty good at kind of being the mediator and reconciling all those different things to actually get a bill passed. So those are the individuals that stand out to me this session.
And of course, from our discussions of listening to you guys over the course of this session or past session, sometimes legislators fall into the good camp on one issue but not so much on other issues, so it's complex. Adam, your thoughts on some of the legislators?
Yeah, no, so I was going to give a shout-out to Senator Alteen. So Senator Alteen, chair of the Public Policy Committee in the Senate, he was responsible for passing through his committee comprehensive bias crimes legislation. I remember in 2011 testifying in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee on the Marriage Amendment. He was opposed to any modernization there. And 2014 and 15, Sunday sales for alcohol. So thinking about someone who might be considered typically socially conservative, for him to be so out in front to make bias crimes bill comprehensive. Again, want to give a shout out there.
Bill.
So with due respect to all the other names that have been thrown out, I think we, you know, can't ignore the work of Representative Houston and stepping in at the as Chairman of Ways and Means.
Well, as we talked to him back in March, I believe, in our call, certainly the tremendous role that he picked up in support of Representative Brown.
Yeah, and maybe just another name that ought to be thrown out there, generally speaking, is Representative Kerekoff, who stepped into the Speaker Pro Tem role, and he's just been, you know, active in a good way, I think, on a lot of issues.
And I think to add to Bill, I mean, I think it's hard to recognize. There was a lot of help we got from a lot of different representatives and senators. There were some that weren't so helpful, but we'll do a legislative vote analysis, right, Jeff?
Well, that does bring us about to the end of our time here, but it will allow me the opportunity to remind you about a couple of the next steps. The legislative session may have wrapped up, but the work continues. You will see in about a week and a half from us, the final legislative report, very comprehensive overview of the things we discussed today and more. After that, Greg just mentioned the legislative vote analysis. That's our annual evaluation of all the legislators, how they voted, whether they align with the pro-economy, pro-jobs priorities of the chamber and the business community. Following the final legislative report through the rest of this year, we will keep you informed through monthly interim updates, the latest going on state and federal levels, interim study committees, regulatory agencies, and more. I mentioned Indiana Vision 2025 earlier. Again, look for that in early June, the release of that biannual report card. We'll be traveling to forums, regional forums around the state. Much more information on that coming. We'll continue our conversations through our Echo Chamber podcast. We encourage you to listen to those. We release a new conversation every 2 weeks there. One coming up at the Fed, another one at the federal level coming up. We'll be talking in a few weeks with Congresswoman Susan Brooks. So we look forward to that in late May, I believe. we'll be sharing that. So once again, thank you everyone for listening today and for your support. Have a wonderful remainder of the week.
Thank you all for your attention. This concludes today's conference call. All participants may now disconnect.